This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network to over 70 community stations around the nation, this is Word for Word. Coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Welcome, family and friends, fans and fiends, to today's edition of Word for Word. I want to thank you for tuning in today. I am Benjamin Norris, and it's simply a delight to continue to work on this show for the Joy Network, which has already featured some of the community's strongest voices. In the tradition of this ongoing program, I continue to look at powerful stories and insights into the life and lifestyle of some incredible people. Each week we will chat with those in and around our community who have inspired us, entertained us, but mostly they've made an impact on the queer community of Australia. Today's guest is one of them. Born in Melbourne, this person is a long-standing advocate for LGBTI Victorians and has held leadership positions in the community and government sectors. She has been recognised for extensive community service, and in 2003 she received a Centenary Medal, and in 2009 was inducted into the Victorian Government's Honour Roll for Women. She has also been a member of three Victorian Government LGBTI Ministerial Advisory Groups and chaired the Ministerial Advisory Committee on LGBTI Health and Wellbeing between 2007 and 2009. Today's guest was the founding CEO of faith-based organisation United Care Cutting Edge and this active member of the community established Victoria's first rural support group for young LGBTI people, giving her a particular understanding of the issues in rural and regional areas. She is a former chair of Adult Community and Further Education Board, the Victorian Skills Commission, the Youth Affairs Council of Victoria and former member of the Hume Regional Development Australian Committee. And currently, she is Victoria's first Gender and Sexual Commissioner. I'd like to welcome you, and I'd like to welcome Ro Allen to Word for Word.
You know, I came out, you can't sort of say late, because there's no magical age to come out. Other people describe me as a butch tomboy.
We're joined in the studio by the Victorian Commissioner for Gender and Sexuality, Ro Allen.
I'm not very good at delayed gratification. In fact, I'm terrible at it.
In the studio with me, Victoria's Commissioner for Gender and Sexuality, Ro Allen. Good morning.
Well, it's just about making people aware that there are trans, gender diverse and non-binary people in the world and in the workplace.
It's the commish in the house with me.
Now it's a real time for the gay and the lesbian people to turn into allies, learn how to be an ally, how to be a good ally for the bi, the trans and the intersex community.
Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I'm so glad that we finally got you here. You know what's interesting is that I'm about to go to a wedding, and the wedding that I'm going to is in Euroa.
Really?
Which is really close to a place of your heart.
That's where my mum lives, in Euroa. Yeah, just down the road from Violetown.
Do you still have your property in Violetown?
We do. Yeah, it's looking really beautiful at the moment. Blossom's coming out. It's gorgeous. We don't get there as often as we probably thought we would, but you know, this stage of our life, this is the job, and the job means that I've got to be in Melbourne and all over Victoria.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but going to Violetown is certainly, you know, a family's mental health escape at the moment.
What's interesting about you, and I always get so, I get a little bit of anxiety just thinking about it, because for your role, you get to go to a lot of events. Being a part of the LGBTI space, we often recognise by celebrating. Do you get sick of going to these events all the time?
No, I don't. I mean, very luckily, I'm an extrovert. Like, I think that's, it wasn't in the KPIs of the job description, but it's people, people, people all the time. And, you know, I know it's very hard on my partner who's an introvert. So events can drain her energy. They just energize me. So going to an event like last night to celebrate 1 year of the Yes energized me. And I was out of bed, bang, into it. This is so, you know, there's so much more work to do. You know, we acknowledge that this is a triumph, but we can't rest on that. Trans and gender diverse and intersex and bi and non-binary issues need the focus now. And so it re-energizes you. And it's that little bit of recognition and thanks that does actually push me forward.
I think it's hilarious. I was talking to your personal assistant, Louise.
Yep.
So to get you here, she's a bit like a party planner, isn't she?
She's gonna got a lot of things.
She's going to hate
planner,
us saying that she's a party
gatekeeper.
Planner.
She gets really stuck into me all the time. Ben says I'm far too accessible and all these sorts of things. Or if I agree to things when I'm out at an event and she's like, you've agreed to that, but you know you've got five things on that day already. And I was like, yeah, but you'll make it work. You'll fix something. And she does. She magically moves things around, and here I am.
This is an exciting week at the moment, so we're celebrating yesterday. But overall, if you look back at last year when that announcement was made, have you got a memory that was quite emotional about that time?
I've got lots of memories. I think I'm not very good at delayed gratification. In fact, I'm terrible at it. So I was the kid that unwrapped my presents under the tree and then wrapped them up again. So the waiting, killed me, absolutely killed me. And they went on and on and on and on and on before they made the actual announcement. And the moment I remember was obviously the announcement. And I'm really fortunate. Somebody filmed me. So I actually have... forever, I have the record of me, good or bad. I don't know if you've seen it, Ben.
I have seen it.
Yeah, it's pretty out there. And that's really it. That's the memory. I hold that sort of visceral feeling of first excitement, then relief, then anger. And I think you see it in the video. I go through all of those emotions in about 5 seconds. And I'll never forget that. I play that video to people and it takes them back to where they were. It's like, where were you when? And it's going to be a memory that everybody holds, in our community anyway, for a lifetime.
Over the last 12 months, because of your position, how many weddings have you been to?
Well, interestingly, not 100. Like, I thought, oh, here we go, everyone's going to want the commissioner at their wedding. But no, it's been really lovely. Really just gone to my dearest and close friends, and that's been lovely. I've been doing that, oh, that's interesting, and finding, oh, I don't know if I'd do that. So we're planning our own wedding, so we're kind of looking at everybody's, you know, wedding and going, oh, that's interesting. That's an idea, maybe we'll take that. So it's been really lovely.
In some ways, when I think of planning my wedding with my partner, like, we've been engaged now for 6 years, so it's a long time coming. We still haven't done it, spoiler alert. And we're both looking at the culture of weddings and borrowing bits and pieces. But I think essentially it'll just be a party.
Well, I think that's wonderful. I think, you know, people saying, you know, there's some members of our community that have said, you know, why would you want to get married? It's so heteronormative. But we can queer up marriage. Like, we queer up everything else. And I think you do need to critique everything that you do around the service, because it's your special day. I mean, I am a person of faith, so we are doing it in a uniting church, and that's because Kay and I met in a uniting church. But, you know, it'll be very queer. I mean, it'll be queer as. It's got drag queens. It's got everybody singing and dancing, and it'll be a very queer event. At the end of the day, it is a party. And, you know, I've married this woman, this lovely woman, 6 times. We have a photo album of all of our weddings as the kid grows up, you know. And she's wearing the bouffant. Nobody else has got the big, you know, meringue dress, but the kid's in one, you know.
How old's your daughter now?
She's 10 now.
Wow.
She's 10. So she's right. She is the wedding planner. She can't decide whether she's going to cartwheel down the aisle, or she's going to throw petals, or we're going to arrive in a horse and cart, or the Dykes on Bikes have offered to drive me there, of course, me there. It's not drive, is it?
The best thing about it, though, of having these 6 weddings and having her grow up through this time, is that she gets to be the flower girl at one of these weddings. Has she been the flower girl?
Yeah, she's been the flower girl. Okay,
now
yeah.
She'll probably be the maid of honour by the time she's, like, progressing up the ranks.
That's right. I think she's excited. You know, we're all excited. Family's really excited.
We're going to get into more of that, by the way. But if we can go back and talk about the origins of yourself.
Mm.
Where did you grow up in Australia?
So I actually grew up in Glen Waverley, so in Melbourne, and, you know, went to, you know, the high school and everything. And I came out, you can't sort of say late, but because there's no magical age to come out. And, you know, we saw people do that. I saw people that coming out at 60. It's never too late. But I came out at 21, so, you know, gone right through that adolescent stage. And
we share that in common.
Yeah. Well,
I was 21 when I came out.
21.
Yeah, it took me a while.
Oh, well, see, I felt that too. But, you know, now you see young people very sure of themselves at a very young age. But
I think sometimes when I see that the younger generation these days do come out a little bit younger, two things happen to me. I have, like, I think, thank God, and we've come so far. But then I also have a tinge of jealousy.
Do you?
Yeah, because I think, oh, I'd love to have been, like, in year 9 and year 10 and having a Dawson's Creek type relationship at school.
Oh, that'd be nice. You're possibly right. I don't think about it too much. I mean, I did my dead ball, Ben. Can you imagine that?
Now, I want the photos.
I know, right? No, it's not going to happen.
No photos, it didn't happen.
No, no, no. My mother's the only one. She's in your row, but you won't find her. She's the only one with a photo of me in a Deb dress. And I did that for peer pressure, but, you know, I did it with a gorgeous gay guy and we had a lovely night. So that was the only, you know, me and drag, I suppose.
Which is amazing. What was your relationship like with your parents as you were growing up?
Look, really, really good, really strong. A very strong matriarch. So mum kind of ran the place. Dad came in and out. And so I came out to mum first and she said, I'll tell your father. So that's how that worked. He didn't cope so well. He had a heart attack and was in hospital for 5 days. He survived. He went on for another 25 years. So he bounced back. You know, later I said, it's a bit of a drama queen, Dad. He's like, yeah, a bit of a drama queen. So,
are you joking me?
No, I'm not. No, he had a physical heart attack.
So that's where obviously the saying comes from. It's from your family.
Yeah, it's from my family. And my sister came out and he just didn't have a heart attack. He just went on whatever at that point.
Well, you know, that's how you work out your muscles.
Yeah. You know. So, you know, that was extreme. So I don't mean to scare anybody, but that was extreme. That's what he did. He got himself into such a panic attack. He had a heart attack.
And how did your mum cope through all of that?
Well, so they didn't tell me. They didn't tell me because I wasn't living at home. So they hid that from me until he was well and home and everything else. And they said, oh, by the way, he's been in hospital and he's okay now.
As time went on, were you able to have an easier conversation with him about your sexuality?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you can imagine that. Okay, so from heart attack to not like head under the sheets, can't even cope with this.
Yeah.
To taking my sister and I and our two partners at the time on a holiday in America in a minibus all together in Vegas. I mean, that's the difference. If you can imagine that, you know, 10 years on from coming out to family holiday with your two daughters and their partners. So he came a long way and he came a long way pretty quickly.
Are your parents still married? They're still together?
No, Dad's deceased. You know, he didn't ever see me become commissioner. I think he would have been...
immensely proud?
I think proud. I think... he was never going to march in... Well, look, never say never. My mum has screamed through megaphones on the steps of Parliament for our rights around reproduction and...
wouldn't have thought that that's what she was going to do?
No. And, you know, being part of PFLAG and... You know, she's 80 now. She had the all the yes banners and stuff in her aged care facility and she did the numbers and she rang me and said, right, I think we're all right.
I've locked everyone down.
Locked everybody down, you know. Yeah, my two daughters want to get married. You need to vote yes. You know, she's a great advocate, yeah.
Growing up, what did your parents teach you? What's something that you walked away from? What's something that you learned?
Absolutely values around social justice. You know, and that's pretty much how I came back to getting Dad over the line. That everybody's equal, that you need to work to strive for that equality. My mother taught me how to do public speaking, so I really just thank her for that because I know some people would rather die than get up and speak literally in front of people. And I've done huge crowds now, so I'm really grateful for that. But I think, you know, all of those values have come from my folks. And volunteering, both of them sat me down once. I'll never forget this. I was probably just about 30. And they sat me down and they said, look, you know, we're really a little bit concerned about how many things you're involved in and, you know, you volunteer on this and you're on this and on this. And then I just sat and I listened to them all and I went, And Dad, you know, you're the president of the Orchid Club and you're the accountant of the homeless shelter around the corner and Mum, you sing on three choirs and you're the secretary. And I ran through there and then they just went, okay, off you go then. You know, and they did. They really contributed wherever they lived, whatever they did. They contributed into community and were volunteers. And they were always at the school working bee. You know, they're always doing that stuff. And they didn't always have a lot of money to put in, but they put their time and effort and energy. And so I think that's something that, you know, I think I've taken on.
It's fascinating when you talk to people, especially like this, and especially to where you've gone in your career. You find the building blocks early on, and I think that your parents' belief in community was really evident. That's how you got to being where you are now.
I mean, I get to do, Ben, you imagine, I get to do really special things in this role. One of the things that I will take away one day when I'm thinking and reflecting back was I was able to give a certificate to a volunteer. There are so many volunteers that go out and visit LGBTI seniors and elders in our community. And there is a trans woman named Annabelle who lives in a nursing home in Violet Town. And my mother visits her. She's one of her visitors. And so my mum organised me to come up to Violet Town and launch Annabelle's poetry book. You know, when your mum says you're coming to do this, it always prioritises it. So it was a Friday night a couple of weeks ago and we launched the book and the aged care facility asked me to hand the certificate out to the volunteer and, of course, it's my mum. And it was really special. She kind of blew it off and went, yeah, whatever. But that's where I learned. That's why I'm the commissioner, because, you know, she's 80 and she's still visiting. And she's visiting, you know, a trans woman who has boxes of these poems under her bed, and she's got them out. She's read them all back to her. They've picked them. They've made them into a book and launched this book, and they've reprinted the book now, and 20 community people came to the launch, and Annabelle cried, and special.
It doesn't matter what age you are, when you can validate and acknowledge your parents in that way.
Yeah, it's so lovely. It's and so do it lovely. Publicly, yeah.
My mum got sent into the Big Brother house when I won the show at the end, before I got released into the general public. And I wanted to say to her, you know, what you taught me was valuable and I value what you taught me. But I just cried the whole way through because it's a powerful moment.
Oh, it is.
And
it
we
is.
Rarely get to acknowledge people in platforms like that. Yeah. But did you cry?
I think my mother would have been really embarrassed had I cried. I got that, you know, that pre-cry, yeah, the pre-cry lump in your throat, and she shut me down. She could see what was going to happen, so she just shut it off. Took the mic and just took over.
I'm an emotional nightmare, so as you tell me that story, I already am emotional. Yeah. How would you describe what you were like as you were a kid growing up?
Oh, look, other people describe me as a butch tomboy. I was a bit of a rebel, but I was one of those nerdy kids as well. I was like a rebel nerdy kid. So I wasn't up the back of the oval, you know, sort of kid, but I was doing music and I was doing a lot of social justice stuff, you know, through the United Church. So I was part of the South African support group because we had apartheid back then, and prison task group. So I was visiting folks in prison when I was about 14, 15, stuff like that. So I was a rebel with a cause. And so when I sort of came out, it was like all my friends were, you know, into those different causes, social justice causes too. So I became the latest social justice cause, really, which was quite funny.
Interesting. So did you enjoy the whole school experience?
Oh, no, it was awful.
You hated it?
Well, I mean, I had a lot of friends in different groups and, you know, I didn't feel like I fitted in any of the groups. So I just moved from, you know, the music students to the maths students to the back of the oval kids, and then I just moved around a lot, but I didn't actually ever feel at home in one group.
I think for me going through school, like, I was marginalized in lots of ways, but I think it's because I couldn't help, like, I was just a very flamboyant person, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
I'm not the blokiest man going around, but, you know, people did pick on me for that sort of stuff. How did you cope with people maybe pinpointing or calling out your gender expression?
Look, ignored it mostly. It had an impact. No question it had an impact. You know, bathrooms were an issue from a very young age about which bathroom I went into. And so that was probably the biggest issue, trying to find, you know, accessible bathrooms for, you know, someone who didn't look like a girl, really.
Isn't that weird, though? Like, it's such a topical thing at the moment.
Yeah.
But again, this is like how your experiences that you had growing up has really been the building blocks for those topics.
Absolutely, you know, and it's a very shared experience from butch lesbian right through to trans mask.
Over your life, if you look at the word queer, are we just starting to reclaim that, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm in the process of helping our community try to reclaim that. So at the moment, government uses LGBTI, and that's in a real acknowledgement that our elders find the word something that they've grown up with that's very derogatory. If I use the Q, I try to always acknowledge, in a very public space, I try to acknowledge the history of Q. I've done some work with the aged care sector recently, and I put a whole slide up explaining Q and trying to get people a bit more comfortable with Q in that space. Obviously, if I'm working with minus 18 or Gen Y or Y gender or any of those other groups, or I'm talking into a youthful space, if I don't use the Q, someone inevitably will come up to me after and say, "Commissioner, you're erasing my identity." So I think when I do training and when I do presentations, I'll put it in there, tailor it and I'll explain why we, you know, why it needs to be explained, really.
What was your first impression of queer culture? Like, so when you were growing up, what did you think of queer people?
Oh, that we were awesome and fabulous. I suppose, you know, in the very beginning, you just have what, for me, it was Ellen DeGeneres and the Coming Out show, and who else was around? Not a lot of Australian role models in the space.
It's actually really strange because if you look at it, there's Mark, as in Bob Down,
yep.
You know, that was a person who was in the media, but we certainly didn't have queer role models to look up to.
No. Karen Phelps, who was the, you know, for me, who was Australian Medical Association chairperson, and she was being absolutely hammered for being a lesbian, just doing her job, nothing to do with queer issues, just for being a lesbian in that leadership role. I was really lucky. I met queer people within the Uniting Church, so Reverend Dorothy McCrae McMahon, so I thought she was awesome. When I came out, my community was a place called Mulcahy's, which doesn't exist anymore, which is now been developed, and you're looking at me blankly, so you have no idea. I'll give you a cultural history tour, Ben. Mulcahy's was a bar in Melbourne where we did country and western line dancing. So I lived in the city and did country and western line dancing, and I moved to the country and came back to the city to do this. And, you know, I really missed that, but that was a community of queers that were just really open, welcoming, fantastic. There were certain rules around it. You know, if somebody asked you to dance, you needed to accept the dance, and, you know, it was really nice.
If you have a look at, like, growing up can be difficult for everyone, what would you say was some of the biggest hurdles that you faced growing up?
Well, coming out for me, you know, I had a blissful childhood, really. I had lots of love, lots of support, yeah, great friends and family, so that was pretty cruisy. Coming out was probably the first big hurdle for me. After childhood, that was really, as I said, you know, my 20s, I think.
What was the first interaction or knowledge that you had of queer people?
Oh, look, it's probably Mardi Gras, to be honest, on television and in those kind of images. So pretty flamboyant sort of images. Mm. Individual people, Melissa Etheridge, again, sort of the American music people that I listened to, Katie Lang, those are the sorts of, you know, that's what I thought you had to be like. And then getting to know real LGBTI people. And I was really lucky. I was very early. People spotted me. I mean, you know, like way, way, way before I spotted myself. So people who were 5 or 6 years older than me, you know, tapping me on the shoulder and saying, you know, hey.
Are you a lesbian?
Pretty much. Even though internationally as well, like, I'll never forget that. I was working for the National Council of Churches, and I went to Korea to the Christian Conference of Asia, and one of the interpreters was a lesbian, and she said, hey, do you want to come out? And we went out to, and I wasn't even out to myself hardly, let alone anybody else. And I was at the opening night of, you know, the very first gay and lesbian, I don't even think it was LGBTI, mostly gay actually, club in Seoul ever opened. I was wow. there on opening night, and it was knock on the door, slide the little window. She said something in Korean, and opened the door, and we went in, and it was really like
a different world.
And so I got to see an international perspective at a really young age as well, and I'll never forget that too, because we can never take for granted the liberties and the freedoms that we have in Australia.
Because you hadn't come out to yourself and people were acknowledging your sexuality before you were ready to, was that a hard experience?
Oh, it was really affirming. If you look back on it, it was really affirming. It's sort of scary.
Yeah.
And they would kind of just call you names that you knew. It was that code, you know, like calling you family and stuff like that, which not everybody understands the code, you know, the secret code and the you know, the secret handshake and all the things that kind of went on back then. But, you know, you got indoctrinated to the language and the code, and that was kind of, it was really lovely to have older people in the community. And for me, I was in a faith community, so having those people support me in that journey and give me so many opportunities.
See, I was not ready for it. Like, I think people would acknowledge my sexuality before I knew what it was, so it always seemed like I'm not gay. You know, so I wasn't feeling like I was included. I don't think any queer people or gay people tapped me on the shoulder and was like, it's okay, there's a family. It just, I felt isolated.
Oh, that's awful.
So I was like, there was no strong role models or people like that around that age. But again, I'm a weirdo. I'm a bit of a freak. I didn't go through puberty till I was 18.
Oh, wow.
So I was really delayed. But for me, it meant that I didn't really understand my gender identity very well, or my sexual identity. But my gender identity that was being seen by people made people assume that I was gay from like the age of 12.
Yeah, right.
Mum would be like, just if you weren't so loud at school, you probably wouldn't be picked on as much, because you're just drawing attention to yourself. But in ways, I think what happens to us as we're growing up means that we learn the tools on how to cope a bit
better. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
So what age would you have been at then to have friends that were also in the LGBTI space? Like, when did you start to make friends that you could trust? And
well, first girlfriend.
How old were you when you had your first girlfriend?
21.
Oh, what? Did you have a first boyfriend? Did you have any boyfriends?
No.
Not one?
I know. See, you're a late starter. I'm a late starter.
Okay, good.
Let's just say I caught up quickly.
And who was your first girl? No, we don't want to talk about her, but...
She was... Look, she's still one of my very good friends.
Oh,
how
really?
Lesbian is that? Yeah.
That's
yeah,
so yeah, lesbian.
Yeah. I went to her wedding. That's one of the weddings I went to. I went to her wedding.
Fabulous.
Yeah, yeah. She's got a lovely partner, wife.
So how long were you with her for?
This is when you start testing me. Okay. When you start testing me on time, she'll ring me up and go, it wasn't that long. And I'm like, well, it feels like I'm going to say 4 years.
Yeah, right.
I think we actually lived together. We did the whole, you know, cohabitation thing.
How quickly did you move in together?
Oh, just embarrassingly early. Yes. Yeah,
the stereotypical lesbian.
Yes, absolutely.
Did you buy a cat? Don't you hate being stereotyped as well? Like, I'm
no,
so
buy
rude
cat.
When I say this to you.
We didn't buy a cat.
Okay.
So that was all good.
But you definitely had a membership to Bunnings.
Absolutely, membership to Bunnings. Yeah. No, we rented a place in the country area, and that was
lovely.
Really quite hard living in the country at that time. But there you go. Still good friends.
How old were you when you decided to move out into the country? Because, like, you've spent quite a bit of time out there.
Yeah, that's right. Look, quite young, you know. They're 21 in age. So we moved up to Shepparton. And, you know, I was overseas and I was challenged about rural youth culture. And so when I got back to Melbourne, I took a job in Shepparton for 12 months, which ended up being 15 years.
Wow. What was that role?
I was a youth worker for the city of Greater Shepparton.
15 years.
Yeah, I know.
What did that job teach you?
Oh, everything. I was certainly persecuted for being in that role. I mean, I ran the very first rural support group for same-sex attracted kids at the time. And so that's when I really saw the hatred really hit and the discrimination and getting lemons thrown on my roof, and I was physically assaulted and car was graffitied and all that sort of stuff that happened during that time.
How did you cope through that experience of being living in a regional area and being alienated for your sexuality and your gender? Like, what coping mechanisms did you put into place for yourself?
Friday afternoon, you get in the car and you came down to Mulcahy's and you danced all night with the queer community, and it was like a battery pack. And you stuck it in the wall and you charged up, and then on Sunday night, I would go back. Oh, and we danced Friday and Saturday night, and it was free entry back then. And we just get a full weekend of community, and then you'd go back and keep going because it was so important. And I've often thought about leaving, but who was going to take the space? And you know, starting a group in Shepparton meant, well, there's nothing in Mildura, there's nothing in Warrnambool, there's nothing. So I became the chair of the Youth Affairs Council of Victoria, and we developed what's now the Hay Grants, which under both governments, Coalition and Labor government, has funded for the last 10 years. And now there's multi-million dollars worth of support for LGBTI young people in rural Victoria.
Well, also, I think all of this experience has given you a language to be able to do, like, the roadshow that you've been able to take out to regional areas and understand that language. So it's sort of also played a role.
Oh, absolutely.
And if you look at Pride Cup Australia and you look at that, you know, going out to Shepparton, is that a really proud moment for you?
Oh, yeah. Like, you know, I said to them, I mean, I'm standing behind a microphone looking out at the football oval in Shepparton, you know. This was a building where I'd been, you know, physically removed from the public toilet 15, 20 years before, you know, all this stuff. And I'm back there and I just took a moment and I said, you know, this is incredible. If you'd told my 15-year-old self, not 15 years ago self, that you'd be standing here at a Pride Cup in Shepparton, with the mayor wearing an LGBTI scarf, you know, a rainbow scarf.
Being accepted, but being celebrated.
Being celebrated. And you're the commissioner, like, you know, from youth worker to commissioner. I would have said you were just tripping. And that's, hopefully that story is really encouraging. I mean, young people have told me that's a really encouraging story because it's not perfect for young people in Shepparton or any or Horsham or Hamilton or anywhere else. But they can see that journey and they go, well, there's hope. And that's the stuff that keeps me energized.
It's a good question to ask you at this point. If you could go back and actually give some advice to 12-year-old Ro Allen, let's just say Ro walks through the door as a 12-year-old right now, what advice would you give her?
It would definitely be, it gets better. And watch out, you are destined for Commissioner for Gender and Sexuality. You're going to get to have the best time. You know, you have to work hard to get there, and there's going to be a whole lot of people that have a crack all the way along, but you're going to come out the other end. And of course, my 12-year-old self wouldn't have listened. Like,
that's what I was going to say. What does your 12-year-old self say to that? Oh, go away.
Oh, look, yeah. That's just never going to happen. You know, I made a suicide pact with my 15-year-old self. It was really bad. You know, I can remember thinking, you know, this is, my life's awful, because I was probably coming to terms with my identity. I went through a conversion therapy. You know, that was a really difficult thing. So I was 15, 16, and I had those suicidal ideations. And I remember, and I've written it down, and I've still got it. I've got a piece of paper that is a pact with myself. I was 15, and I wrote it down, and I said, right, okay, I'm giving this another 15 years. At 30, if it's still this terrible, I can call it quits. But I have to give it another 15 years. Anyway, I had the biggest 30 birthday, you know, and I had, you know, you're 30, so you've got the choices about what you spend your money on. And it was, I can remember thinking, am I going to buy a fridge? Or am I going to have this party? Well, I had the party. I booked a band. You won't know this band either, Ben. That's right.
No, tell me what the band is. I never know.
Blue House?
No, I never heard of it.
They're a huge lesbian band in Melbourne. Yeah, see. You have to look it up, play a song. It's a great band. So I got, you know, I got the band, I got the party, and I just, you know, I knew at 20 that I wasn't going to cash in the contract. But still, that when 30 came, it was a really special day for me because I'd been through that.
It's so full on to think of you, because I think of you because I always see you at the different functions and you're very stoic to me. You're very happy. You're very personable. And I can't imagine your 15-year-old self making a pact like that when you have been a leader of social change. But at the same time, it's a real understanding that you can relate to young people because of going through that.
But that's what I would say, Ben, to all young people, even if you're at that point, like I was at, you know. And, I was sitting around waiting for God to heal me, and I was wondering why this conversion therapy wasn't working, and it was horrific. And I wasn't out, and I wasn't out to my family or friends or anything. And if I can go from that point and be in the role that I'm in now and loving life with a beautiful 10-year-old kid who still likes me, I don't know what they'll do at 15. I heard it's pretty bad. You can be shaky when they turn.
Might turn a little bit.
Like turn a little bit and then come back eventually.
But then they'll definitely come back.
But at the moment, you know, she wants to hang out with me and I've got a wife to be. And I just like, well, wow, imagine if, you know, and you do. And that makes me sad because I think about all the people that don't make the pact or can't hold the pact for all sorts of reasons. And, you know, self-harm and suicide is a real issue in our community. So it's certainly something that obviously I work really hard.
You're pretty cool.
Oh, thank you, Ben.
I think you're pretty cool. When I hear all these stories, I think you might be one of the coolest people I know. Maybe that says something about the people I'm hanging out with. No. Interestingly enough, if you look back at the ideas of conversion therapy and considering that they still do exist here in Australia, was it your decision to go to a conversion therapy or was it your parents or was it your peers?
Yeah, my parents had no clues. Like, and they would have been horrified to know I was even there, I think.
So you elected yourself to go?
Yeah, and, you know, there was an older guy who was a real evangelical in the church and he'd gone off to this AOG kind of place and you know, again, people spied me for good reasons and people spied me for bad reasons. And he went, oh, yeah, I reckon you're probably struggling with this and you should come with me to this. And he was spot on. You know, I was at that time, you know, struggling and trying to reconcile that with my faith and my spirituality. And I was really torn. But, I'm grateful. I mean, it sounds weird, but I'm grateful for the experience because I can walk into Brave now, that the support area with LGBTI people, and I understand. I have a visceral understanding of what an exorcism feels like.
What were the processes that they were using on you to?
Well, it's an ideology. It's an ideology about being broken, I tell you, it's the same ideology in 2018 as it was back then.
Wow!
It's that you are broken, and that we can heal you, and you know, you are not your full self, and there are explanations, and that you are not born LGBTI, and this is something that's because of something that's happened in your life or a relationship with your mother or your father. You know, it's the same stuff. If you've seen Boy Erased, it's pretty confronting kind of stuff. But yeah, it is happening in Victoria. It is happening in Australia. Maybe not the organised programs that were so around back then, but certainly the ideology is still there.
What a horrible language to use to young people to give them the notion that they're broken or that there's something wrong with them.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So it's so important that we speak into that community, and which is why, you know, in the last 3 years I've run multicultural, multi-faith forums. We've run 3 forums and we've invited all the denominations to come. Last week I met with the Catholic Diocese and we're going to do an LGBTI People of Faith forum with them, which will feed into their plenary in 2020. And, you know, it's really important that I have those dialogues. And I do sit down with Dan Flynn from the Australian Christian Lobby and have those conversations so that we park what we can't agree on, Dan and I, and we talk about the things that we can agree on, which is self-harm and suicide of young people. And, you know, he's open to talking about that. I mean, fundamentally, the thing that I always try to remember around conversion therapy stuff is sometimes the people doing it are queer. So that can be part of it. And even if they're not part of the community, they still fundamentally believe they're doing God's will. Even though they're doing very dangerous things for our mental health, they don't. It's not like somebody walking down the street and actually targeting you and beating you up. These people actually think they're doing you a service. So it's a different conversation. Mm-hmm. I suppose I have the grace to go to that the well of graciousness around that. Otherwise, I couldn't sit there and have those conversations.
Do you think that we'll ever see conversion therapies completely removed from Australia?
I do. I have to have that belief. Otherwise, I wouldn't, you know, keep working in this space. I think people understand the damage that it does. And you're already seeing changes. So now the groups are saying, oh, well, we can't heal you, but we can help you be celibate. So we're already seeing, which is not good and not fulfilling and life-giving and God-giving, if you ask me. But the language is changing.
Well, they're not living their best life if that's what they're doing.
No, they're not.
You know, so much of what it is that you do and how you relate to people is by sharing personal story. Is there anything that's off the table that you go, you know what, I'm not going to talk about that?
Look, I think there's not a lot. I think people have interviewed me now and got, like you,
got
Ben.
Got it all out.
Most things. I mean, you know, I'm not sharing my intimate secrets and I'm certainly not perfect. I wouldn't take relationship advice from me, you know.
We'll ask your partner.
Yeah. But, you know, now it's okay. But, you know, when you come out late, you know, all those mistakes you're meant to make in dating and adolescence, you're not meant to make them in your 20s and 30s.
But we do.
We did. Well, I did.
Well, you can still. I'm making them in my 30s.
Oh, are you? Okay.
I'm really delayed. No, but I think that
they're
something
more serious, I think.
Yeah, but I think that's fine to be in living your own timeline.
Yeah.
You know, like, it would be nice if maybe we, as I said earlier, if we had our little Dawson's Creek relationships in our teens, but we didn't.
Yeah.
And then we got to have them in our 20s. So we're slowly working through.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
There's nothing wrong with that.
You've got 20 years experience in community services. What did you study at school when you first came out of high school?
Well, that's an interesting story. I did VCE and then went, oh, I need to just go to the School of Life. So I got a university place and deferred for a year to my parents' horror. And never went back. So education was a later thing for me, much later. So I just started as a youth worker. I wouldn't recommend this pathway to anybody now.
Oh, come on.
Well, qualifications are really important, but you don't get caught up on it.
So did you ever go back and try and find higher education?
Look, I did a diploma. When I was actually managing a whole lot of people in community services, I thought, oh, I better have a certificate. So I did a diploma and then started sort of almost teaching the subject. So that was, it did that fairly quickly. I was chairing the Victorian Skills Commission and I was in charge of $1.2 billion of government funding. So I thought I'd better go and do the Australian Institute of Company Directors course. And you
That's know, a lot of responsibility.
Yeah, there's a bit of responsibility. So I've done the qualifications and the work that I needed to do along the way when I've got there. So it's been a different kind of journey. I enrolled in my master's, so skip the degree. Went into my master's and then I think I picked the wrong one and I got pregnant and I went, ah. And so I didn't finish my master's either. So there you go. That's my educational track record. But
look how successful you are. Life University.
Yeah, it's unusual. Well, that's right. The University of Life. It's unusual to be a human rights kind of commissioner without being a lawyer. But I think it certainly hasn't been a barrier. Last month I got invited by the Chief Justice of the Federal Circuit Court to go and speak to 70 judges around issues for our community that face them in the court system. So, you know, I think I can do work around what I don't know, I go and learn. Or I think a leader surrounds themselves with people smarter than themselves. So that's been my strategy as well.
I think that's so powerful to lend on other people. You know, just the other day, a friend of mine was telling me about what it is that I don't do very well. I shouldn't beat myself up over it because what I do well, I should acknowledge instead
That's
of spending
it.
My time beating myself up for the things that I just not for me.
Yeah, I had this conversation with a group of colleagues yesterday. I mean, a different person would make this role different. You know, if a lawyer was in this role, there maybe have been more focus on you know, legal interventions in some of the work. And I think, you know, I've made it my skill set. I've worked in the areas that I have experience in, multicultural, refugee stuff, or rural and regional with the roadshow, or queer conversion because of, you know, lived experience in the faith space. I think, you know, whoever comes after me will make the role around their skill set, or they're mad if they don't. Mm. And then you draw in people. And the Victorian system, what's really terrific is we have the task force, which is a, you know, LGBTI task force, which sits in the Department of Premier and Cabinet, and it has a justice working group, and it has a health and human services working group. So also, I'm not a medical person, so I don't begin to understand all of the 40 different chromosome variations for someone who has an intersex variation. So I need to bring in the people with the lived experience and the medical knowledge to explain that.
Lean on them.
That's the important thing. And give them a voice. I mean, that's, for me, that it's about not always being behind the microphone, but making sure that you give opportunities for others, which is why we've, you know, established the leadership program. So we're in the second year now. We're taking registrations, I think, for the LGBTI leadership program with Leadership Victoria. So we'll see 3 years of that, and we'll see hopefully an alumni of people that are really diverse from our community that can start to help them get that voice and start leading.
You know, you've been on lots of boards and part of communities and committees over all of these years, and you definitely have a skill set that has led you to be successful in these environments. You know, what is it that you believe that you bring the most amount of strength to in these roles? I can think of them. I'm already like,
okay,
respect.
Oh, okay.
You know, understanding, empathy.
Listening. Listening, and hopefully that's what people would say. Listening and facilitating, I think, is my skill.
Interestingly enough, like with your role here in Victoria, which was created, you know, through the Andrews government, Victoria is the only state that's got your role.
That's it.
Why is it throughout the rest of Australia that we haven't seen that in New South Wales, Queensland, West Australia?
Look, there's a lot of tire kicking in the other states. They're watching what's going on in Victoria. I think there's a lot of the queer community that would like to see a commissioner in other states. I think it may happen. Federal opposition has a policy for a national commissioner that may see more state commissioners. But, you know, I think I'm completely biased, Ben. I think the role has been incredibly successful for what I've been able to lever from all different parts of government.
Are you able to have those conversations with premiers of different states and try and connect to them and say,
I have.
Hey, mate, or,
Yeah, I have.
Look at what I've been able to achieve.
Yeah.
And can you see statistics on what it is that you've impacted?
It is really hard to quantify what I do. And I get asked that question a lot. And it's, you know, the outcomes are individual stories about, you know, the impacts. So, you know, I can quantify things like before the rural and regional roadshow. I mean, people said, you know, why did you use the chief commissioner of police's bus? And I would make a joke, oh, well, I don't have a budget. I use everybody else's budget. But
you're just saving some money by borrowing someone else's bus.
Well, yes, Ben, but it's also very strategic. You borrow the police commissioner's bus, it guarantees that police will turn up at every single event that you do in all the locations. And, well, there you go. We went from 170 LGBTI liaison officers to 265 LGBTI liaison officers after the roadshow.
Well, I think it's strengthening communities. That's exactly what it's doing.
Yeah,
it's building relationships and organising a much bigger net behind what it is that you're, you know, creating for the community.
That's right. It's trying to embed it right across government and right across community.
So what would you say you've brought to the role that you're most proud of? So you've been in this role now for how long have you been?
Nearly 3 years.
And what would you say you're the most proud of?
It's like picking which child you pick up as you run from a burning building. So many things. Look, certainly the work on the roadshow and the impacts we've had in 29 towns, bisexual community, I think we've raised some visibility around bi issues. The work with the intersex community is slow but is moving ahead as well. And just moments, just really great moments that I've been privileged to be part of, I think. Having now done two retreats for Aboriginal LGBTI community and being invited to those spaces and being called an honorary curry and just for the day and all those things just have been amazing for me to be part of. And the multicultural, multi-faith workshops where we've sat down with bishops and really had strong dialogue and conversations, and you know, all those things have been really amazing, as well as the corporate work and, you know, the sports area. I mean, I'm just not a sporty person, so to go to, you know, ice hockey and drop the puck at Pride games and flip coins at football games and not even know the rules to half these things. I'm an absolute athlete on the whole coin flipping thing now. You know, and roller derby Pride games and, you know, swimming in a blow-up tube with the trans community and the water polo team, and like so many people I've met, so many wonderful things have happened.
What's the focus at the moment?
I think is just finishing up on the conversion work, the intersex work, getting a whole lot of things ready for next year around the leadership program. The grants round is out again for sustainability for our LGBTI grants. That's always tricky. It's always oversubscribed. Luckily, I don't have to make the choices around that. There's smarter people than me that get to read and do all the detail work on that. But
that's more leaning on other people.
It's leaning on the other people because I, you know, I'm very bad at picking winners. I just want to give everyone a car. I'm like Oprah.
Just looking back and looking at sort of from the ground up, how do you tackle signs of hatred? So, like, I guess you've grown up in Melbourne, but you've also grown up in regional areas. Once you've been able to see that there's levels of homophobia, biphobia, transphobia, what ways do you use to tackle those?
Look, I think reporting it, like if it's to yourself, is really important. Whether you choose to carry it forward, I think even doing something like that is a really powerful thing to do if you're able to, because if nothing else, even if the perpetrator of that violence isn't called to justice, you've got a record of that, and we can see how many times there's LGBTI discrimination in our community. So reporting it is really important. I always like to go to my happy place, you know. On Facebook, the staff can do, you know, enormous posts and elaborate setups of photos and beautiful writing, and might get 1,000 likes or something. I put a picture of me in my ride-on mower in my happy place, and, you know, it just goes viral. Because I think people connect to that. I think you've got to do the self-care things. So for me, if it's that sort of homophobic or transphobic sort of violence directed towards me, I deal with it straight up, heads up, report it, deal with it, try to make sure the people that maybe have also been impacted feel supported, and then I do something nice for myself.
You go to your happy place.
Go to my happy place, which is usually, well, when I'm home in Violettown, it's my ride-on mower, because I put the earmuffs on, and, you know, you can see the direct impact of your work. Like, often I don't see the direct impact of my work, but a mower, right, you turn around, you can see, you look back, it's straight lines, it's perfect, you know, and you know you did it, it smells terrific, it's fabulous.
It's something so simple, but it's something so powerful.
You're in control of it. You're in control of that act. And often in my job, you know, you set things in motion. You don't have control over it. You know, you have to let other people control. As a control freak, that can be really hard. And you don't often see, you know, the benefits or the impacts of your work, often for, you know, 2 or 3 years down the track.
Yeah, it's very interesting when you look at the reasons why things happen and how you motivate yourself and how you motivate other people. A weird question to ask is, and someone was talking to me about this the other day, why do you think that drugs and alcohol have been so prevalent within the queer community for so long?
I think for our community, we gathered in clubs and, you know, we gathered in pubs. That's, you know, now it's a bit different with social media, but much of the culture of our community of coming together was in alcoholic venues. Look, I'll be working with groups in next year, particularly to look at alcohol use and particularly things that we fund as government around, you know, alcohol. You know, there are a number of big parties that you buy expensive tickets for in our community, and then people just want to drink the ticket price back. It's like a competition. I think we can lower the ticket prices and have purchasing of alcohol and more responsible serving of alcohol. And that allows a trans guy from Mildura who can only afford $60 for a ticket, who's happy not to drink, to come down and actually access that event. But if it's a $200 ticket, it's out of the realm of that young fella. So I want to provide opportunities where things can be more accessible to people, and there's not a culture around. I mean, I'm going to be known as the Wowser Commissioner. It's not about saying no alcohol, but, you know, why are lesbians smoking? You know, we know the health impacts. They're smoking more than, and bisexual women, than heterosexual women. So why is that, and what can we do to support a more positive choice around our health? And people use drugs to change We know. Statistically, people use drugs to change their emotion. And if they're not in a happy place,
they'll try and use that.
They'll use drugs, alcohol, cigarettes to change that space. So fundamentally, how do we help people get into a happier space to make better choices?
Do you think we were set back a little bit with the plebiscite, being that Malcolm Turnbull selected to have a plebiscite in Australia and the No campaign? Do you think that there was a massive setback for the queer community?
Oh, look, I'll say this. The postal survey was a process we should never have been put through. Our community or any other community, and I would continue to fight, whether it's Aboriginal, constitutional, referendum question, no other. We have to learn from this experience. There will be generational impacts. They're already going to be. There already is. We lost people. People that were vulnerable didn't make it through the postal survey. And I know that. I know people particularly. And so that's a process that the costs of the win, it's bitter. It's bittersweet because it had a huge impact, particularly for trans, gender diverse, bi folk and people that had an underlying mental health issue. I mean, as leadership, you know, people who said they're very evolved, they're out, they're very confident in who they are, they're supported by their family and friends. Those people found it difficult.
Well, I had some friends that are some of the most confident people that I know come to me and say, Ben, I'm really struggling through this. And I would have attributed them as being some of the most confident, happy, embracing people of their sexuality, never even heard a flicker of emotion.
Mm-hmm. And that is absolutely right. And that's a very shared lived experience. And so we must never forget and never let it happen again.
Was there any way of being able to stop that plebiscite? Like, do you think that it would have been better to have stopped the plebiscite and allowed for marriage equality to come across maybe even a few years later?
I mean, it wasn't like we sat back and let it happen. The High Court said no, the government is in their right to call this. And there was moves to ignore it, but I think that would have been really bad. Once it had been called, once all the challenges to it had been ruled out, we had to fight it.
And we fought it and we won.
But there's still 39% of Australians that voted no. And we all know that. At some level, we all know that. And there's a lot of pain, particularly, as I said, for the trans and non-binary folk during that, because it was really hard. They were the ones that were thrown under the bus. They were the ones, you know, rainbow families and trans people were put up as the slippery slope argument. And now it's a real time for the gay and the lesbian people to turn into allies, learn how to be an ally, how to be a good ally for the bi, the trans and the intersex community.
Some politicians that I'd spoken to, they thought it was a bit of a myth that maybe the community hadn't been affected as badly as we said that we were. What do you have to say to those sorts of people?
They need to look at the stats. They need to look at the switchboard call rate. They need to look at the work that Beyond Blue and Lifeline did during that time and all the services. The Victorian government put over $1 million into the mental health of the LGBTI community during that time. You can see every time the media talked about running a plebiscite or a postal survey, the spike in calls and web chat stuff. You can't argue the data. It upset people. And anecdotally, we know, and I can tell you from my own experience, and you can from yours. It was a horrific month and a half, I think. I can't remember how long it was. It can go forever.
Can you give me three people that you thought made the biggest impact during that time?
Oh, no, I can't.
Come on, just give me three.
No, no.
You know, like, it's like that question where you say, oh, what celebrities or famous people, dead or alive, you'd have at a dinner party?
Oh, that's easier.
If you could have... Let's do it this way, though. If we mention it like this, if you could have a dinner party with three people to celebrate marriage equality.
Let me say this. Who did I ring yesterday? I'll tell you who I rang yesterday or spoke to yesterday to say thank you. I rang Will Stark.
Yeah.
And I...
First person invited to your dinner party.
You know, I spoke to Ali Hogg and Anthony Wallace, and I went to the 86 because I think Equal Love were there 10 years ago before John Howard changed the legislation, getting people on the streets. And I think there's all sorts of spaces for advocacy. I think there's room absolutely for what I do, which is the behind doors advocacy. And then there's the people that get out on the street and, you know, paint the signs and do the education in that space. And I think that's a lot harder. But we also need the people on the ground, and so they're the people that I think made... I mean, everybody, my mother who spoke to 10 people in a nursing home, I mean, everybody that had those conversations, and it's just too hard to answer because it took all of us to get that vote.
And as we celebrate 12 months on, a year on, you know, we sort of can look at the learnings that we had to get marriage equality across the line. What are some of the things that we should use some of those processes for to get across the line now?
Well, I still think we need to be on the street. We need to be having the conversations. We need to be educating ourselves about what the trans issues are and the non-binary issues are and the issues for the intersex community and making sure that they get a voice. And when we need to be ringing our politicians and having those meetings and, you know, learning from what we did well and do it again. Clearly it worked. And, you know, one of my mentors, as I mentioned earlier, you know, Reverend Dorothy McCrae-McMahon, she said one of the things she taught me was revolutionary patience. It means you just keep working, you keep hard, and you will get there. So to answer your question about would I have waited? Yes, I would have waited because the damage the postal survey did wasn't worth me being able to get married, frankly. I would have waited. But then that's my personal opinion for someone who is at the end of their life and they really wanted to get married. But the cost of that was so, so immense that, you know, I know it wasn't worth it.
Still a few band-aids that we're definitely going to need to put on.
Oh, absolutely. A lot of work.
Have you got a message for the queer community that would be listening to this now?
Stay strong, stay connected, know that your experience is valued and listened to, and thanks for having me. I'm very humbled to be your Commissioner for Gender and Sexuality.
Well, we're very happy to have you.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you for joining us on Word for Word.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Ben Norris from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations across the community radio network.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.